is in the matter of Joseph Sakala. May we please have appearances?
Deputy Ethics Counsel Ho Chin Kim for the Office of Attorney Ethics.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. Lawrence S. Catello, O'Toole Scrivo, LLC, appearing on behalf of respondent Joseph Sakala.
Mr. Sakala, I see that. Please go ahead.
Respondent Joseph Sakala.
Because this is a recommendation of disbarment, you'll have the opportunity, if you'd like, Mr. Sakala, to address the court after your counsel does. And if you want a moment to consult in private, we'll accommodate that as well. Ms. Kim, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and members of the court. This matter is before the court upon a recommendation by 6 of 8 members of the Discipline Review Board to disbar respondent Joseph Sakala for his knowing misappropriation of client trust funds. The majority of the board found Mr. Sakala knowingly invaded funds belonging to his clients in his attorney trust account to pay himself his contingent legal fees on settlements before he received and or deposited the settlement checks into his trust account. Two board members dissented, finding Mr. Sakala committed only a negligent misappropriation as he thought he was disbursing from his monies left or commingled in his trust account, recommending a censure. The Office of Attorney Ethics relies upon its submissions below and the detailed decisions of both the Special Ethics Master and the Discipline Review Board to respectfully request, bless you, the court disbar Mr. Sakala for his acts of knowing misappropriation. As pronounced in Ray Wilson and recently restated in Ray Wade, an attorney will be disbarred when she takes client monies without authority from the client to do so. Here, the only way Mr. Sakala was able to take his contingent legal fees early was to use the client funds being held in his attorney trust account to pay himself before he deposited the related settlement check. Mr. Sakala never advised his client or asked for his client's authority to use those funds in that manner. As testified to, Mr. Sakala only checked the trust account balance to see if his disbursement check would be covered, despite not knowing which client funds made up the balance in his trust account. His defense of negligent misappropriation is unavailing here because Mr. Sakala testified these 6 instances of knowing misappropriation were aberrational. The inference being that he knew not to invade his trust account to take his fees early, and the other, I believe, about a dozen cases involving settlement funds. Also, Mr. Sakala only ever disbursed his fees to himself early. He never disbursed funds early to his clients or even to third parties. And lastly, Mr. Sakala admitted his practice of doing so was improper. He also admitted during his interview with the OAE in 2017 that the funds in his attorney trust account was probably mostly client funds. As found by both the Special Ethics Master and the Disciplinary Review Board below, there is clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Sakala knowingly misappropriated and invaded client funds in his trust account to pay himself his contingent fees early. For his act of knowing misappropriation, the OAE submits disbarment is warranted here.
Ms. Kim, were there other sufficient funds in the accounts?
The OAE conducted its audit of Mr. Sakala's trust account, looking to see if he truly was commingling funds in his trust account. And we could not find any excess legal fees in his trust account, but for the approximate $10,000 of Mr. Cardenti's funds that were on loan to Mr. Sakala. But the OAE did not find any legal fees being commingled in the trust account.
Questions, anyone from us?
I just have one. I got on mute here. Oops.
You're unmuted, Justice. Now you're muted.
Right now, okay. Do you know how much money was in Mr. Sakala's trust account at the time that he was withdrawing money before he received the settlement, approximately?
Justice Alvin, the balances varied. I believe it is in the trial record. During cross-examination, we went over the balance in the trust account. Every time the legal fee check was negotiated against the trust account. So it is in the record. It wasn't millions of dollars. I think it was either in the five figures, typically.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you, Ms. Kemp.
Thank you.
Mr. Catallo.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Respondent Joseph Sakala has practiced law with an unblemished record for nearly 25 years. During that time, he's been a dedicated public servant and a solo practitioner. The six client matters at issue in this case arose from Mr. Sakala's dabbling in personal injury cases and at a time when Mr. Sakala was overwhelmed personally and professionally and did not employ a bookkeeper. At the virtual hearing, the OAE did not show by clear and convincing evidence that Joe Sakala knew he was taking other client trust funds when he withdrew what he believed to be his earned attorney's fees. In those six client matters, Mr. Sakala transferred his attorney's fees from his trust account to his attorney business account after matters settled, but before the settlement checks were deposited into his attorney trust account. Mr. Sakala did so because at the time, he believed he had a cushion of his own funds commingled in his attorney trust account and because of poor record keeping. Mr. Sakala consistently testified he believed there was a buffer of commingled funds in his attorney trust account, despite the special master and disciplinary review board's efforts to say that Mr. Sakala's position changed from his uncounseled demand interviews through the hearing. Thus, at the time of Mr. Sakala's conduct, he didn't know he took a client's money as opposed to his own intermingled funds. Any misappropriations were negligent and not intentional, as the two dissenting members of the DRB found. We're cognizant of the court's recent decision in In re Wade that the Wilson rule has not been changed and that disbarment remains mandatory if a knowing misappropriation is proven. But this case isn't Wade, and Joe Sakala isn't Dion Wade. There are crucial differences between those two cases. Here, there are no outright admissions. Mr. Sakala didn't admit that his trust account was a personal line of credit and using it as such over a 15-year period. Mr. Sakala didn't admit accepting individual client trust deposits and then borrowing against them. The OAE, in this case, never identified what specific client funds Mr. Sakala invaded. And importantly, unlike Ms. Wade, Mr. Sakala did not take trust funds over the entire course of his career. He did so in only six client matters over a discrete two-year period. And over that two-year period, he had handled over 650 cases. Thus, this case isn't Wade, and there were not intentional misappropriations. This case is more akin to In re Lucid, where the court found that an attorney's use of client A's funds to pay a settlement owed by client B while awaiting receipt of client B's funds was a negligent misappropriation. This case is also similar to In re Caruso, where this court departed from the DRB's recommendation of disbarment and found negligent misappropriation where an attorney took a $15,000 worth of attorney's fees, despite that that disbursement created a shortage of required escrow funds. All that separates this case from Lucid and Caruso is the number of matters at issue. In two of the six matters here, Mr. Sakala withdrew his earned fees the same date the settlement check was written, but before receipt of the settlement check. In three of six matters, only two or three days passed. In one matter, 8 days passed. And these are all aberrations. Now, this counting is conceitedly complicated because Mr. Sakala, despite possessing the checks, didn't immediately deposit them. But he nevertheless deposited the checks. He nevertheless possessed the checks, which contained the client funds in the bank drafts. Once the checks were deposited and after those brief periods of time, respondent's trust account deficiency was cured and no client suffered any actual harm. Another key difference, as I touched upon earlier, it was the OAE's position that the settlement check had not cleared and therefore any withdrawal of funds was a knowing misappropriation. But instead of tying the alleged trust fund invasions to individual clients, the OAE claimed for the first time at the hearing, without marking a single exhibit in this regard, that there were no commingled funds in Mr. Sakala's account for the audit period.
Mr. Cattell?
Yes, Chief Justice.
If there was no cushion in fact and no basis to believe that there was a cushion, then we would have an invasion of other clients' funds, correct?
Yes.
A knowing misappropriation.
You would have an invasion of the client's funds.
So tell us, please, what is the amount of the cushion that Mr. Sakala thought existed, and what's the basis for his conclusion, his belief?
Mr. Sakala believed at the time he made the withdrawals, at those periods of time that were between 2014, 2015, and 2016, at those various times, he had an understanding of what his trust account balance was, but he did not know specifically what the buffer of commingled funds was. He believed that there was a buffer at the time he made the withdrawals, but he was unaware of what that buffer was.
So without knowing what the buffer was, how could he take this money?
Subjectively, Mr. Sakala believed there was a buffer, and in checking his trust account deposit, that was his belief at the time. He subsequently came to learn during the audit process that was not accurate, but at the time that he made the disbursements, that is what he believed to be true.
So put aside the specific amount of the buffer, I understood your answers. What is there in the record that tells us his belief that there was a buffer of an indeterminate amount was a reasonable belief?
As Ms. Kim noted, Mr. Sakala gave several interviews to the Office of Attorney Ethics. In his first interview, he specifically responded that he believed that there was probably a mixture of client funds intermingled in the account, but that most of the funds were probably client funds.
So then again, that's a statement, perhaps a conclusory statement. What I'm wondering is there something specific that he relied upon to justify the belief that there was a buffer? Had there been a very large payment of sorts that he had not taken out? Was there anything of that nature? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do. Again, as Ms. Kim alluded to, there was a $10,000.
The Cardenti matter.
Yes, there's a $10,000 pot of money that Mr. Cardenti, one of his clients, had authorized him to use. That sum of money was in the trust account for certain periods of time during the audit period.
Anything in addition to that?
Not that I am aware of at this time, but we submit that Mr. Sakala's subjective belief, as well as the Cardenti funds, which he had express authorization to use, or in the account during some portions of the audit period when at least some of these withdrawals were made. And it was also Mr. Sakala's practice, and other times he did not always withdraw his earned fees immediately.
So counsel, excuse me. In the case of Patricia Raines, which was in January of 2016, Mr. Sakala took out $27,431. And that was 20 days before the settlement check was deposited. Excuse me. Am I correct? I'm looking at your brief, page 8.
Yes, Justice Alden, that's correct.
Do you know how much money was in the trust account at that time?
I would have to look back further at the record, but it is my understanding that Mr. Sakala had well in excess of the $27,000 that he withdrew at that time in his trust account.
Well, we know he had to have at least $27,000, otherwise that would have created a problem. There had to be at least $27,431 in his trust account, because that's what he withdrew.
Yes, Justice Alvin, that's correct.
So are you telling the court that your client believed that he had a cushion of $27,000+ in January of 2016?
That was Mr. Sakala's testimony at the hearing, that he believed that there was a buffer at the time sufficient to cover that withdrawal.
And where did that buffer come from? Where were those monies coming from that constituted the buffer?
Again, Justice Alban, that was Mr. Sakala's subjective belief at the time that he made that withdrawal, that he had sufficient of his own funds remaining in his account when he made that withdrawal.
Mr. Cutella, can you also address the forced matter? In this case, as I understand it, Mr. Sakala withdrew more than $5,000 before the release and the settlement memorandum had been signed. Is that correct?
According to the materials before me, the release and the settlement memo was dated April 14th, 2015, and he withdrew the funds on April 14th, 2015.
Can you point us to a spot on the record? And I'm not looking to catch you flat-footed on this, but can you point us to?
Yes, I'm referring to the chart that Justice Alban referred to in my brief on page 8.
So he took the money on the 14th.
I am sorry.
I'm looking at the DRB's decision right now, and it says that the release of claims was not signed until April 16th, and that, looking at page 22, 2 days before the release and settlement memo were signed, respondent paid himself $5,000 toward legal fees and expenses. If the DRB is correct, how could he have taken that money when he did?
So let me step back to your earlier question. So respondent's testimony at the time of trial accurately recited that the settlement was worked out on April 13th, 2015. April 13th, 2015. Respondent withdrew his fees on April 14th, 2015, and Ms. Forst came in and signed the release on April 16th, 2015. So your honor was correct that there was at least a brief gap between the date that the release was signed and the monies was taken, notwithstanding that the client had consented to the settlement before that time.
So sometimes agreements fall through before they're finalized. We all recognize that, no?
That would be a fair statement, yes.
So how was it appropriate for Mr. Sakala to take this money before the ink was on the signature line and the deal was finalized?
We don't contend that it was appropriate. We contend that it was not intentional that Mr. Sakala took the money early. It was merely in this instance and as the others an oversight in this matter as it was in the others.
You basically claim in each one of these instances, he was just taking his own, he believed he was just taking his own money out of the trust account. That's basically your argument. Yes?
Yes, our argument is Mr. Sakala subjectively believed he had a buffer of his own funds when he withdrew the funds on each of those occasions.
So your position is that even if there had been no settlement, no money coming in, he subjectively felt that he would have been able to withdraw these funds at any time because those were monies that belonged to him. That's your argument?
Well, it's more nuanced than that, Justice, because in the other matters beyond the one that Chief Justice Radner brought up, the release was signed and the settlement check had indeed been issued by the insurance carrier.
Yeah, I understand, but I think you would admit that you cannot remove, assuming that other clients' monies were in Mr. Sakala's trust account and nothing else, you would admit he couldn't be withdrawing money from some other client while he's awaiting a check from client X.
Yes, we acknowledge we could not have withdrawn other client funds while we were awaiting a check from client X.
Is there anything in the record with respect to this particular transaction, the forced one, that would explain why he waited 21 days to deposit the check?
The record is replete with Mr. Sakala's explanations that he was personally and professionally going through a difficult period. And in addition to that, he had numerous appearances that required him to be outside of the office for periods of time. And despite that the matter settled and the settlement checks were in the mail, he had not returned to his office to open the mail, review the checks, sign the checks, and deposit those settlement checks into the bank. In one instance, he had 15 court appearances in 17 days, and he was not in the office for that period of time, which in circumstances like that led him not to deposit the settlement checks after he had received them, and which led to some of these, despite that the settlement checks were dated very close in time to the dates of the withdrawal of his attorney's fees and the date of the actual deposit of the checks.
So maybe you can explain this to me. It's not as though there was a long period of time between the issuance of the check and Mr. Sakala taking money from his trust account. Like, what circumstances were so dire or desperate that he just couldn't wait a couple weeks? Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. There, we submitted there were no circumstances that were dire that required Mr. Sakala to take his fees early. It was merely his practice and his misunderstanding of what was going on in his trust account that led him to believe there was a buffer and he could take those fees at the time the release was signed and the settlement check was written. What separated, like I said, Mr. Sakala was out of the office and did not want to wait until the settlement checks arrived to disperse his fees to him, which he believed were earned at the time the release was signed.
Please go ahead, counsel.
Thank you. I believe where I left off was that despite that as Chief Justice, you've identified, and Justice Albin, you've identified that, and that, and similar to the OAE's position, that to the extent Mr. Sakala made these withdrawals before the settlement check had arrived, other client funds were impacted. But there's an important point to be made here, and that is the OAE and the DRB never identified what specific client funds were invaded. So we are left in a position where there's never been a showing on what individuals' funds were improperly taken, and we now have Mr. Sakala facing disbarment without anyone ever proving what client trust funds were invaded for these brief periods of time.
If the only money in a trust fund was client money, what's missing from the presentation?
What's missing from the presentation is the OAE and the DRB were not able to tie what specific funds, what specific client funds were invaded by Mr. Sakala when he made the withdrawals. And all we have is bare testimony from the OAE auditor made it the first time during trial that she went back to 2014 and at the hearing testified that there were no commingled funds. There was never an accounting report. There was never any other evidence beyond that conclusory testimony that there was no other funds in the account.
Mr. Cattell.
Your client testified that it was mostly client funds in that trust account. And even as we sit here today, you're unable to point to anything besides the $10,000 that would constitute these commingled funds. So again, I'm having trouble understanding what is missing from the presentation when it seems that admittedly, most of the funds that were in that attorney trust account were client funds. We have $10,000 from that matter that he was authorized to use, but he's taking withdrawals well above that amount. And you have pointed to nothing else, no other deposits in that account that would account for any, this buffer that he subjectively believed was in that account.
Well, Your Honor, in one instance, there was a $27,000 withdrawal. In the other instances, they were much smaller, $4,700, $6,000, $5,300, $13,000. So in most instances, they were relatively small amounts. The respondent submits that the OAE should be required to show specifically what client funds were invaded, and it seems to be a missing element of proof, or otherwise you're left with circumstantial evidence and inferences that client trust funds were invaded. If we're just going on the testimony that there was nothing but trust funds in the account, when no one's ever tied the invasions to specific client funds that have been improperly taken.
Mr. Cattell, your client was admitted in 1995 in the state, am I correct? It was admitted to practice law in New Jersey in 1995.
Yes, that's correct.
And as an attorney in New Jersey since that time, he was required to take certain continuing legal education courses to keep up with the requirements of a practice of law. Is there anything in the record that shows that he made any attempt to get an understanding of the record keeping requirements that are imposed on an attorney who has a single member practice like your client?
We submit that Mr. Sakala was aware of the record keeping requirements but for this brief period of time, because he became overwhelmed in his personal and professional life. He was going through a divorce. His daughter had several surgeries on his back. He stopped for this brief period of time doing the trust account reconciliations through QuickBooks, and was for that reason these things occurred.
So he was aware of the requirements and he had this personal crisis, and that's what stopped him from continuing to keep the records up to date?
Yes, he began keeping the records by hand rather than using QuickBooks, and that led to these things slipping through the cracks.
Did he make any attempt to hire someone to help him, like a bookkeeper or someone else, to help him with the accounting requirements to make sure that all the funds were properly segregated and not invaded by other clients' disbursements or his own disbursements?
He did not, like many other solo practitioners. Mr. Sakala was running his own practice and trying to devote every cent that he earned in his practice to his family and his children, and to growing his practice.
I may have asked you this question, but what, other than the Cardenti matter, what made him think that he had a buffer? Was he not taking fees out from other cases? I'm trying to understand why he had this subjective belief that he had a buffer.
Mr. Sakala believed at times that he did not take all of his earned attorney's fees out of his trust account, that he hadn't moved them out of the account. And therefore, as he testified at the demand interview, that there was probably a mixture of his own funds and client funds in his attorney trust account.
Did he testify to how much money he thought he had withdrawn at any particular time? Like, what was the maximum amount he believed he had as a buffer?
No, he did not testify to that, Your Honor. I'd like to, if I may, briefly address respondents' contentions that this matter should have not proceeded before the special ethics master in a virtual manner. In that respect, it's clear from the argument here today that this matter was complex and should not have been held by Zoom in violation of the court's April 20, 2020 order. Stepping back even farther, the nature of this case, misappropriation, and the severe consequences that flow from it dictated that this matter should have been held in person and not by Zoom.
Can you tell us specifically how your client was harmed by this proceeding being conducted virtually?
Yes, Mr. Sakala and I were not in the same room during these proceedings, and Mr. Sakala was not able to participate in his defense in the manner that he wished to do so. He was not with me and was not able to look at documents with me, and was not able to assist in the answering of questions, both on that were asked of me and that I needed to ask to the auditor on cross-examination.
Was there a restriction in place by the special master that Mr. Sakala could not be with you?
No, there was no restriction in place by the special master, but at the time we were observing COVID protocols and Mr. Sakala and I could not be in the same room at the time in January and February 2021.
Did you ask for opportunities to consult privately during the proceedings that the special master denied?
The special master didn't deny any requests in that regard.
I understand the overall argument, but can you identify specifically, like, questions that would have been asked had you been in person, or responses that Mr. Sakala would have liked to have given had there been an in-person proceeding?
Well, for example, Justice Albin, there was a question that there were issues in the Montana matter where Mr. Sakala allegedly dispersed his attorney's fees in three instances, And the special ethics master found that she had no explanation on why he did so. And because he dispersed the monies in three installments, she found that to be inculpatory. But in fact, Mr. Sakala made those disbursements in that regard because there was a fee split with another attorney. And he initially thought that the fee split was what he initially thought the contingent fee was 25% rather than 33%. So in the first installment, he took his half of the 25%. In the second installment, he took the difference between 25% and 33%. And in the last installment, he took costs that were owed to him under per the terms of the engagement. Now that testimony did not come out well during the hearing, and I submit that if Mr. Sakala and I were in the same room, that would have been cleared up very quickly. And instead, the special master found that didn't make any findings in that regard, and instead found that those installments were the way he dispersed the monies to himself were somehow inculpatory when there was really a very straightforward explanation.
So just why would it have been cleared up if you're in the same room together, as opposed to you couldn't clear it up because you're in the same sort of virtual mode you're in today?
He could have simply leaned over to me and explained to me what occurred, and we could have cleaned it up. That wasn't able to happen during the virtual proceeding, where we were virtually separated between when we started in the morning, broke for lunch, restarted, and then broke at the end of the day. That's how the virtual proceeding occurred.
What technology was being used for the virtual proceeding?
Zoom technology.
And that has a chat feature?
Excuse me?
Does that have a chat feature that allows for private chats?
I believe it does have a chat feature. I do not know if it was enabled at the time, and we did not avail ourselves of it, much like I am not chatting with Mr. Sakala here today while I am participating in this proceeding. Another point I'd like to make is again a procedural one, and that is the court in November of 2021 recognized that most proceedings involving severe consequences should be held in person, absent consent between the parties. Those include sentencing hearings, termination of parental rights, trials in municipal court matters involving a jail sentence or loss or suspension of a driver's license. Here we submit that Mr. Sakala's hearing before the special ethics master should have had similar protections. He did not consent to a virtual hearing, and he should have, like these other litigants, should have had a in-person hearing so that the special master could observe his demeanor, make credibility determinations, and view him in person and view his testimony in person while the hearing was going on. An attorney facing disbarment or permanent loss of their profession should have, like I said, equal or greater protections than parties in those other matters, and certainly as similar protections to a person who is simply facing the suspension of a driver's license and the loss of Mr. Sakala's law license permanently. We submit should have had equal protections, and that the Office of Attorney Ethics and the director of the Office of Attorney Ethics exceeded their authority when they determined this matter was relatively straightforward, not complex, and could proceed via Zoom in contravention of the court's prior orders in that regard. I would like to, again, briefly touch upon mitigation. We submit that.
Can I just ask you one question? Are you asking for a redo in person? Is that part of the relief you're seeking?
We submit that the only remedy could be a redo at an in-person hearing.
Okay.
And let me touch briefly upon mitigation. We submit that discipline short of disbarment is warranted based on compelling mitigating factors and no aggravating factors. If there is a finding of negligent misappropriation, the mitigating factors are indisputably relevant for consideration. Even if there is a finding of knowing misappropriation, we submit that the mitigating factors ought to be considered as had been stated in several concurrences and dissents by the Supreme Court.
Mr. Cotello, on that last point, Wade addresses some of those concurrences and states quite plainly, if it's knowing misappropriation, we don't look to the mitigating factors. And in cases of negligent misappropriation, the court does not have a history of disbarring. So if you want to tick off briefly for us some of the mitigating factors, you're welcome to do so. But the law, as stated in Wade, is quite clear on this, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor, we don't disagree, and I was not going in the direction of going through all the case law out there on that point. As I said at the outset, Mr. Sakala has been a dedicated public servant over his entire life. He is a former mayor, a former councilman, a former Board of Education member. He has had a demonstrated commitment to community service. Four witnesses came forward at his hearing and testified regarding his character and reputation. He has remorse. He has a lack of any prior disciplinary history, and a significant amount of time has passed since the random audit through now that we submit that if this is a negligent misappropriation matter, there is ample amount of mitigating evidence to cut against any violations of the rules of professional conduct. If Mr. Sakala is given the opportunity to practice again someday, we submit that the matters at issue here will be a blemish on his career, but that they will have all been rectified and that Mr. Sakala will have learned his lesson. We believe that no clients were harmed. There was no actual monetary loss. And notwithstanding that the Wade opinion, looking to the future, has set up a system or looking for input whether disbarment should be permanent, we submit that nothing in life is certain, and Mr. Sakala should have discipline short of disbarment, because even if the court's pronouncements in Wade are effectuated, if he were to be disbarred by this court, it is uncertain whether he would be reinstated in the future.
Thank you, counsel. Before we turn to Mr. Sakala, Ms. Kim, did you want to respond to the argument you did not address in your first presentation, the virtual proceedings?
Yes, thank you, Chief Justice, for the opportunity. I would note that the argument regarding the Special Ethics Master's decision regarding some sort of misapprehension about the payments in the Montana matter, that was only brought forth in her written decision recommending disbarment to the board. So Mr. Sakala's remedy was given to him. He briefed the issue to the review board. So having an in-person hearing regarding that particular matter would not have clarified the special master's understanding of those disbursements, because again, it was not revealed until she issued her decision. I would note the special master listened to all the witnesses. I do not believe she asked very many questions. So if she did have some sort of misapprehension, it would not have been brought forth in an in-person hearing because she did not have any questions. This was raised to the board, but I will reiterate to the court that in ethics matters, ethics hearings, If there are special circumstances, testimony can be given via telephone or video conference. And it was in the past accepted pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and even now. I tried a matter of knowing misappropriation where the attorney respondent testified via telephone with no issues. And so having the opportunity to have a virtual hearing where a witness and the attorney respondent is on camera at all times, such that the trier of fact can look at the person testifying, actually at times is more compelling, because our reactions can be seen on the video screen. And so the OAE did not abuse the discretion granted by the court in proceeding in a virtual format. The OAE submits that it properly followed the dictates of this honorable court in proceeding with ethics hearings that are given priority, even during the pandemic.
So Ms. Kim, Mr. Cutello has argued that he was deprived of the opportunity to speak with his client during the hearing. Do you have a response to that?
I would concede it made things much more difficult because I too did not have the auditors sitting right next to me assisting me in presenting the OAE's case. But I was able to either communicate with the auditor, my witness, via email or texting. And thus the master made it clear that if we wish to have any sort of break, we would be given the opportunity to do so. So it might not have been as convenient as sitting next to each other, but technology being what it is, communication still could have been effectively had between Mr. Cutello and Mr. Sakala.
Thank you.
So I have a question of Ms. Kim, if I might. You've heard Mr. Cutello say that you failed to show an invasion of a specific client's monies. Now, I've witnessed many, many proceedings where you and other members of the OAE have come before the court and have specifically said that on this date, this client's funds were invaded. Why wasn't that done in this case?
Typically in misappropriation cases, invasions are taken out of a specific client's monies, settlement monies. Let's say, for example, the Montana monies came in and the attorney then took more monies than that person, the attorney was owed from that particular settlement fund, let's say. This situation was almost the reverse. And so monies were to come in, but monies were taken early, not from a particular settlement. It was legal fees coming in on a settlement, such that it was all the client funds that were in the attorney trust account. And so I think I understand where Mr. Cutello is coming from in stating that the auditor testified for the first time at the hearing. But that is the job of the Office of Attorney Ethics. We would be remiss if we brought forth charges of knowing misappropriation without ensuring that we knew those facts definitively. We also wish to find funds that prove that Mr. Sakala was commingling because he was a sympathetic respondent attorney. Perhaps the OAE did not pinpoint every particular client that had funds on the specific date, but Mr. Sakala had provided us all the client ledger cards, all the client funds that were for those clients whose monies he was holding during the audit period. And we even went back, we went beyond the start of the audit period. And so we knew whose monies were supposed to be in the trust account. and those monies were in the trust account without any additional funds from Mr. Sakala. So even though the OAE might not have listed every single client on a particular time, we knew whose monies were in the account because Mr. Sakala
told us. You're saying we knew. So, but you're presenting, a case is presented to a special master. Did the special master know? Was there testimony presented that these clients had monies in Mrs. Sakala's trust accounts and they amounted to this amount and this amount and this amount, and therefore taking out $27,000 had to have invaded their accounts? Was there testimony of that nature? Not what you know, but what was presented to the special master?
The OAE did not break down on the particular date when Mr. Sakala issued his payment check to himself of the amounts of all the client funds in the trust account. We actually went the inverse way in stating per the ledger cards provided by Mr. Sakala that the only funds in the trust account were client monies. That was the understanding, and that was the fact of the status of Mr. Sakala's attorney trust account. And so with that baseline, that it was only client funds, we tracked down the attorney, the clients that we could to see if any client authorized Mr. Sakala to use their monies in the manner that he did. And or we also looked for any additional funds on top of the client funds in the trust account and did not find any, but for the
I understand. What you're telling us, was that all presented to the special master, just as you're telling us?
Yes, I believe through the testimony of Auditor Tiffany Childs, we went through what she accomplished during her investigation and audit of Mr. Sakala's attorney trust account.
Any other questions of Ms. Kim? Thank you. Mr. Sakala, as we noted at the outset, you're welcome to address the court. You need not do so. And if you'd like a brief period to consult with your attorney before making that decision, just tell us.
Chief Justice, I'm prepared to give a brief statement to the court. And right now, I don't need any time with Mr. Cotello.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rabner and Justices of the Supreme Court, and thank you for this opportunity to allow me to make this statement. This process is now 5 years old, and as you can imagine, it's been very disheartening to me on many, many levels. And I just want to address a couple of those. To begin with, the special master, we've been talking about her. I, for one, cannot comprehend or understand how the special master in this case could conclude that as an attorney, that I'm a danger to the public. And she said that in her opinion. I've been practicing law for 27 years, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars passed through my trust account every year. There has never been an allegation about missing funds or overdrafts. I have no prior ethics history. I've been elected 4 times over a period of 11 years to represent the public in my community. In that capacity, I've administered school budgets of over $25 million and municipal budgets over $12 million without incident or question ever. I volunteer a day every month to assist a matrimonial bar in Hudson County on the matrimonial early settlement panel. I've been told verbally and in writing by judges and members of the staff in Hudson County that I'm an asset to the bar. I served on the District 6 Ethics Committee, represented them at the DRB level. I was appointed numerous times in Essex County by the assignment judge and other judges to be a condemnation commissioner. And I can go on and on, the point of all that is that I've been placed many times in positions of trust, and I've served admirably and honorably. For the special master who doesn't know me, she has never sat in a room with me. She's never looked me in the eye. For her to hold in the manner that she did is troubling to me. And I understand that if this court reaches certain conclusions, that there's nothing that this mitigation that I'm speaking of or some of the mitigation I'm speaking of can be taken into account. But I also believe that you can't make a ruling on one's career and livelihood based upon a ledger card. And that's what it comes down to. This comes down to my ability to practice law, to earn a living, to support my family. In my life, I've been very lucky to have raised three great kids. My oldest daughter just finished her first year of college on the Dean's List at Fairfield University, and my son starts Bucknell University in the fall, pursuing an engineering degree. I've always taught them to follow the rules, but I've also taught them and told them that it's okay to make mistakes along the way because you learn from your mistakes. And in that vein, this has been a learning experience for me. I am a good lawyer. I'm thoughtful, I'm knowledgeable, I'm empathetic. I care about my clients a great deal. When I put my head on my pillow at night and I have my problems going through my head, I also have my clients' problems going through my head. I take them with me everywhere I go. There are many people, many clients depending on me, some of them who I've represented for 27 years, as long as I've been a lawyer. And they're gonna be disappointed and upset when and if they learn that I can no longer represent them. The period of time during the random audit that we're speaking of was a pretty tumultuous time for me. Increasing personal issues, specifically in my marriage, and also in my marriage stemming from, amongst other things, the murder of my mother-in-law. To assisting my then 12-year-old daughter in her recovery from a serious 8-hour surgery that she had at NYU Langone on her back, and doing this while trying to ensure that my cases were covered and my clients were attended to. And I'm saying these things not as examples, or these examples not as an excuse for my actions, but as an explanation for my carelessness. I should have been more careful, and I should have been more diligent in my actions during that time period. I was not, and for that I am sorry. But I did not and would not knowingly misappropriate client funds. After 27 years of representing clients in courts all over the state and advocating zealously for them, I still find it difficult to advocate for myself. So it doesn't come easy to say these things, and I'm not being, you know, flip in saying them or saying this. And I say this with all sincerity, that the legal profession will not be better off if this court rules in accordance with the disciplinary review board. In fact, I believe just the opposite, that the profession will be worse off, maybe by just a smidge, but worse off nonetheless. To conclude, I ask most respectfully that you take all the above, along with the arguments of my counsel, into account, and you side with the dissent at the DRB level, where they found that I acted negligently and negligent misappropriation was found. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scala. We'll take the matter under advisement.